Hello, my name is Cy Gart. I'm a scientist, a writer, and a Christian, and I want to welcome you to my podcast, The Works of His Hands, which is also the title of my prize-winning book published by Kriegel Press with an introduction by Alistair McGrath. The subtitle of the book, A Scientist's Journey from Atheism to Faith, describes the major theme of the book, and this podcast will include episodes on similar themes, not just about my own personal journey, but also exploring the connections between modern science and Christian faith. Remember, science is distilled doxology. My main comment about intelligent design is that I don't like the title of the term, and I'll explain why. I don't think any of the Christian scientists that I know, the Christian biologists that I know, would hold that life is not designed. I think that it's clear that there's evidence of design. In fact, even many prominent atheists like Richard Dawkins will agree that life appears to be designed, but it isn't really. Well, we tend to think, yeah, it really is designed. But the reason I don't like intelligent design, that word, is I think it kind of demeans the design. I think the design of life is way beyond intelligent. I like to use the term divine design because I think life is designed in a way that no intelligent person could even dream of. In fact, we still don't know many of the details of how life came about, most of the details about how life came about. So, you know, the most intelligent group of folks in the world could get together and they couldn't design life from scratch. We don't have a clue how to do that. In terms of philosophy of science, one of the big issues I think that keeps coming up in discussions of philosophy related to theology and science is the whole issue of teleology. Is there a purpose to the universe? Is there a purpose to life? Everyone will agree that it looks like there's a purpose, okay? The mouse runs away to avoid getting eaten, and the cat chases the mouse to satisfy his hunger. So, okay, that looks like there's purpose in biological activity, but my view is that that goes very, very, very deep, all the way to the core essence of biology, and that's a philosophical idea. You know, the history of physics is fascinating because in what was it, about 1900, I think, there was a book published by Lord Kelvin. And in that book, he quoted some people who said, well, we're really done. Physics is done. There's a few decimal places that have to be filled in. We know all the laws. After Maxwell's equations, there's really very little left to do. Of course, we don't know much about biology, but, you know, biology used to be considered metaphysics. It wasn't really considered real science because, you know, there were no equations, there were no laws, none of it, it was messy. I mean, you know, how do you do a science of biology? I mean, Darwin was really sticking his neck out even to propose anything scientifically. And what happened after that was, you know, several revolutions, among which were, of course, obviously relativity, quantum theory, which threw physics way on its head, and no longer was physics and science in general considered to be this nice, logical, rational, reasonable, you do the experiments, you get the results, they make sense, they explain the natural world beautifully, like a machine, and you keep going. No, that was dead. And not only that, but, you know, with Mendel and then others who started looking into biology, into biochemistry, as a matter of fact, and when that started happening, people said, well, you know, there's actually science in biology as well. Maybe it's not metaphysics. Maybe it's real stuff. And so we're way behind the physicists. But, you know, I think it's true that we're going to hit those limits in biology as well. And the result won't be an end. The result will be a revolution, as would happen in physics. And, you know, if you think about it, physics, because there are many branches, but there are some branches of physics where the only way you make progress is with mathematical and theoretical work. You can't do the experiments anymore. Who knows? I mean, it's a fascinating, wonderful time to be a scientist. I think clearly we have to stick with methodological naturalism. Otherwise, whatever we find out, we'll never know if it's true or not. But we'll have to expand because if Heisenberg had said, no, this doesn't make any sense. How could it be true that we can never be certain about the position and the momentum of the electron at the same time? That's just not logical. It makes no sense. You know, forget about it. And if Planck had said, how does it make sense that you go from one energy level to another energy level without going in between the two? You just jump from one to the other. Sounds like science fiction. And if they had said, no, this can't be true, this doesn't make sense, we wouldn't be where we are today. So, we may have to be brave in biology. We're not proposing, doing away with methodological naturalism. We're proposing, if anything, we're speculating about what else one may need to use to reach truth. But one good approach is philosophy. And this raises the whole issue, the philosophical issue of what's called scientism, which is the idea that methodological naturalism, everyone agrees, that is the way to get scientific truth about the natural world. But what not everyone agrees with is the idea that it's the only way to get all truth. And some people do hold that position. The new atheists hold that position. I think most social scientists would disagree with that idea. There are other ways to seek truth other than methodological naturalism. How do you get truth in history? How do you get truth in philosophy? How do you get truth in arts, etc.? So that's a separate issue, which people will disagree about. But in terms of the natural world, absolutely, methodological naturalism is the only way to go. And the point I tried to make, I didn't make very well, is that methodological naturalism has historically changed its definition as science expands. And I think that evolution, if I may, of the methodological naturalism may very well continue. LUCA stands for Last Universal Common Ancestor. And LUCA was a cell, a hypothetical cell, and it's considered to be the minimum possible biochemical entity that can exist that gave rise to all the rest of life. And what's fascinating about it is that we know, because all life, one of our dear colleagues, Kent Hovind, who we all know, has said he doesn't understand how pineapples and I think elephants, if I remember right, pineapples and elephants could be related. Well, pineapples and elephants, if you look at their cells, they're remarkably similar. They all have DNA. They all have the same genetic code. And by all, I mean all life forms. They have the same system of protein synthesis, which converts the genes into what the phenotype is, the way the cell actually works. And all of, so we deduced that LUCA, the last universal common ancestor of all of life, already had a tremendous amount of biochemical complexity, almost unimaginable. And then, of course, modern bacteria, which are very much more complex than that, and not to mention all the rest of us, eukaryotes. So LUCA, the challenge in Origin of Life is to get to LUCA. And LUCA could be considered the Big Bang. Okay, that's where life is evolving for those of us who, believe in evolution, like me, and is evolving into bacteria, is evolving into eukaryotes, is evolving into eventually animals, plants, and us. But you got to get to LUCA, and that's very, very tough. And that's the challenge that looks almost insurmountable. And I'm perfectly comfortable theologically and philosophically to say that, yes, I agree that it was a divine agent. It was God. But when I'm talking about it scientifically, even if I believe that God did it, as people like to say, I want to know how. And I think the path forward is to investigate how was life created, whether it was by God or whether it was a natural chemical process that involved no supernatural at all. we still want to know how it happened. And I think that that's an interesting route to take. Both, I mean, it's actually the same route, whether you're believe in God and God did it or you don't, you still want to know how it happened. And, you know, it's possible that someone will come up with explanations that all fit chemically and all are completely rational and reasonable. That has not happened yet in many, many, many different problems with origin of life. But it's not enough to just say, well, we don't know, so therefore God. What I think is we have to say, we don't know, so let's keep working. And maybe we should include the God hypothesis and see if that leads us right to some mechanism. Now, I don't know how to do that. Okay, that's not for me. Somebody else is going to have to figure out how to do that. But I think that we don't give up on the scientific method when we reach a stumbling point. We have to rethink the scientific method, and we have to somehow go past that stumbling block. My view is that once we reached Luca, by whatever means we did, we meaning, you know, the universe, once Luca existed and was a population of cells, what then? How did life diverge into first very complicated single cells like bacteria, and then eventually eukaryotes, and then multicellular animals, and then plants, and then eventually, of course, us and other very complex animals? And to me, the answer is design by evolution. And in fact, I mentioned earlier that I'm giving a talk next week, and I remember the title of the talk. It's Evolution, the More Intelligent Design. In other words, the evolution of biological creatures to occupy every niche of the planet, to have the tremendous diversity that you see in everywhere you look, and to have such incredibly beautiful teleonomically oriented design, you know, whether you're talking about a cheetah or a bird or a person. I mean, we have tremendous amounts of data and evidence that this occurred through a process of variation caused by genetic variance in a population, and followed by natural selection. And the data for that is very strong. And I don't see that as in any way antagonistic towards the hypothesis of a design creator or a creator who designs. Because to me, evolution is the tool. Remember I said before, I'd like to know how God created life. I think we know how God created the diversity that we see, and the tool that was used is this brilliant idea of evolution. And what really gives that credence to me is that evolution is often considered to be just a natural thing that life does, but it's not. In order to have evolution, you have to have a very specific and very complex set of biochemical mechanisms going on in cells. You have to have very accurate replication of the cell contents. And the way that happens is you can't replicate proteins. They don't self-replicate in any way. But you can replicate nucleic acids. And if nucleic acids have information that codes for proteins, you end up getting variation and you end up with the possibility of evolution. So what I'm interested in is the origin of evolution, even more than the origin of life. Because it's the origin of evolution that I think requires some kind of amazing design that we eventually see in all cells. So the evolutionary theory right now is in tremendous flux. And I think the idea of gradualism or continuity in evolution, which was one of Darwin's original ideas, that's been shot down for quite some time. I mean, some of the great, I mean, starting with Gould and Eldridge, you know, the idea of punctuated equilibrium kind of did away with that. And there are some people who still hold to the old gradualism idea, but they're not in the forefront of evolutionary biology. And instead, what we have now is what I find incredibly exciting. And this is not coming from theists, by the way. Most of these scientists are atheists, or at least agnostics, but there's something called the extended evolutionary synthesis. What we now are looking at, what I'm not, but other people are looking at, are some fascinating new mechanisms for how we get variation and rapid variation. I mean, you get things like transposons inserting into a control element, and all of a sudden 16 genes get turned on and you end up with a whole new system. And that kind of a very complex and very rare genetic changes which cause variation and lead to rapid changes in phenotype seem to be probably what's driving many of these major transitions. I mean, it's known that, for example, the vertebrates, there were two big whole genome duplications at the origin of the duplicates. It's a very rare event, happens almost never. The idea is that there are natural laws which lead to biological outcomes that are more powerful or can substitute for natural selection. And probably there's some value to that. I like to mush them all together because I don't think it's one or the other. So structuralism, yeah, I mean, I think it's an interesting idea. The idea of natural law in biology is one that has not been explored enough. I think Conway Morris is one of the pioneers when he looks at constraints, although that whole work has not been developed into, you know, law-like mathematical structures yet, but it probably will be. And I think there's a lot of that. The whole issue, the whole realm of gene regulatory networks, which is a fascinating area that I got involved in a couple of years ago, just had a paper published on it, is one that kind of speaks to that idea of structural law that determines an awful lot of how biology works, but we're just at the beginning of that.
Thank you for listening to this episode. Please subscribe to my podcast and also check out my website at cygar.com. Take a look at my YouTube channel, Faithful Science. Science is spelled S-Y-E-N-C-E. And follow me on Twitter and find me on Facebook. Thanks again, and God bless you all.